Council, ready to proceed?
May it please the court. My name is Cheryl Rush Milstead, Your Honors, and I'm here on behalf of the juvenile defendant below, and with the court's permission, I would refer to the parties in this action by their familial situation. I'm juvenile stepfather, so as not to misspeak and use the last name as opposed to the pseudonym applied by the court for reasons of privacy. You know, and I believe the case that's before Your Honors is a question of looking at the acts of both the juvenile and determining whether they were assaultive or self-protective, and also looking at the acts of the stepfather to determine whether they, in fact, were acts of discipline or assaultive. Briefly, the case presents itself, Your Honors, as one in which the juvenile was at his house, the stepfather came home, the juvenile was angry, was yelling, went to his room. Unfortunately, as many teenagers do, he slammed the door. The stepfather went to his room, opened the door, was verbally aggressive and yelling at the child. The child came to the door. There was an argument about whether, in fact, the child had done the damage to the door that the father claimed. At that point, the stepfather pushed the child into the room. There was testimony to suggest that that happened twice and perhaps three times. Each time, the stepfather pushing further into the room and pushing the child backwards and down. The testimony then indicated that at the second or third time, when the child was on the floor and his back against the wall, he looked over and saw his lacrosse stick, and he picked that up and hit his stepfather in the hand with that. There was some verbal taunting by the stepfather. At that time, the stepfather then left the room. The juvenile said he finished getting dressed at that point and was planning to leave the house to go next door to a relative's house so he could calm down. And at that point, again, the stepfather approaches him near the back door, and they both end up on the floor. There was some physical contact between the juvenile and the stepfather, and the juvenile testified that that was because he had felt some pressure on his windpipe in his throat area and was trying to get the stepfather off so he could breathe. The testimony also seemed to indicate that when the police arrived, the juvenile was calm and compliant. So it wasn't a case the child was completely out of control. The defense presented the case, Your Honor, as we said, that it was not the juvenile who was being assaultive. He did hit his father, or stepfather, but it seemed certainly to be last resort after being pushed in the room and no apparent cease on the stepfather's part to this behavior. That ended, and the child attempted to leave to protect himself again. And again, there was a confrontation, and the child did what he thought, once again, he could do to protect himself, to stop the pressure on his windpipe. And, Your Honors, that was the substance of the case, that the acts of this child were not assaultive against the father, except to protect himself, to stop the assault that was going on, and to get away from this stepfather.
And what's the nature of your legal argument, if those are the facts? Is your argument simply that this was self-defense? And if it's self-defense, what's our standard of review if the family court judge listened to all the testimony and concluded it was not self-defense?
Your Honor, the court looks at de novo, and it seems to me that the standard is whether any rational trier of fact, which would have been the court below, and viewing that evidence in the light most favorable to the state, could have found the essential elements of assault, and that's what the court below did. I know the defense made a motion for judgment of acquittal at the end of the state's case, which was denied. The defense then presented the juvenile to testify on his own behalf, and then argued at the end for the self-defense, and the court found otherwise.
All right. We understand that from reading your briefs. So now it appears you've identified two legal issues. The first, in the state's case, is insufficiency of the evidence. And then the second issue is self-defense. Now, what do you rely on in support of your first legal argument regarding insufficiency of the evidence?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that the reviewing court has to look at the decision of the court below and the information presented and determine whether the trier of fact was correct and viewing all the evidence in the light most favorable to the state made the appropriate ruling.
Well, Ms. Rostad, the court found against your client on the facts, so unless there was an error of law, that result stands. What's the error of law?
I believe the error of law, Your Honor, would be in not addressing the issue of protection, self-protection. There didn't seem to be any address by the court of that issue, even though it was raised.
Was that argument raised in your brief?
I believe it must have been alluded to, Your Honor.
Well, was it fairly presented?
That I don't know if it was fairly presented. I know that there was the arguments to be made were the motion for judgment of acquittal at the conclusion of the state's case, and I believe at that time the argument for self-defense was made.
Well, and let's again, see if we can separate your two legal arguments. Tell us why the judge erred as a matter of law in denying the motion for a judgment of acquittal. Tell us where the judge went wrong.
There was sufficient evidence at that point to conclude that the stepfather was not blameless, was not harmless, and had in fact participated in the acts that resulted in the child picking up the stick. And that evidence had been presented at that point in the trial, and it seemed as if that evidence was completely disregarded by the court.
Thank you.
Well, let me raise a different question than those you've raised. Can you square for me the physical injury element that's required for assault in the second degree and the definition of dangerous instrument, which, as I understand our law, an object constitutes a dangerous instrument if it's used or attempted to be used in a manner rendering it capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Now, the way in which the lacrosse stick was used here on the facts, even as the family court judge found them, what was it about the use that would have caused the court to conclude that it was a dangerous instrument in that it caused serious physical injury rather than simply physical injury sufficient for the element of assault in the second degree?
Well, the defense argued that, Your Honor, that there was no serious physical injury, in fact, because the stepfather had gone to the hospital. There were x-rays taken. He complained of some pain that lasted more than a day, in fact, perhaps up to a month. But the defense argued there was no serious physical injury, and the state replied that if the defendant was using an instrumentality that was considered dangerous, then the state only had to prove physical injury and not serious physical injury.
Well, the state had to prove physical injury for the purpose of an assault second. But the mechanism by which the assault took place, it's alleged, is a dangerous instrument. And in defining dangerous instrument, it has to be an object that's capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Let's assume that the swollen hand, though it was x-rayed and there were no broken bones, constituted physical injury. Where is the evidence of serious physical injury that would allow someone to conclude that the way in which the lacrosse stick was used here, a strike to the hand with the plastic portion of the lacrosse stick, how does that cause serious physical injury such that the court could conclude that the assault took place by a dangerous instrument?
I believe the court must have concluded that serious physical injury would have been a possibility. Well, because there was no evidence that there was serious physical injury.
Well, okay. If someone had taken the lacrosse stick in two hands and hit the other person in the head with it while he's not wearing a helmet, as he would be during a lacrosse game, perhaps so. But this is a single strike to the hand with the plastic portion of the lacrosse stick, as I read the record.
Correct.
Where is the serious physical injury?
There was none, Your Honor, and that was also argued in family court. There was no serious physical injury. The record indicates what I've already said, that the father went to the hospital. There was x-rays. There was no broken bones. There was no serious physical injury.
Okay.
And do you have any additional argument?
Nothing additional, Your Honor, unless there's any other questions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for any rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the Court. This case presents a single legal issue, that is the sufficiency of the evidence. There was a defense motion for judgment of acquittal at the conclusion of the state's case. There was a single witness, the complaining witness, the stepfather, who testified, and there was a single defense witness, the juvenile accused in this case, and then there was a ruling by the trial judge in this family court bench trial at the conclusion of all of the evidence. The standard of review has correctly been stated. This court has de novo review. The question is whether any rational trier of fact, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, could have found the essential statutory elements of the assault second-degree allegation beyond a reasonable doubt. The statutory elements are relatively straightforward. They're set forth in subsection A2 of section 612, title 11. First is required either reckless or intentional conduct. The state, in its juvenile delinquency allegations, alleged intentional conduct here. The second statutory element is that this intentional conduct has to cause a physical injury as opposed to a serious physical injury to another person. And then finally, has to be by use of a dangerous instrument or deadly weapon. Again, the state's allegation was that the lacrosse stick, the instrumentality employed by the juvenile, was a dangerous instrument.
Can I just interrupt you now?
Certainly.
Let you run with the question. Ask the public defender, because it's obvious that's the one thing that's troubling me about this case. How do we square away the definition of dangerous instrument, which, as at least as I read the law, requires that it be used in a way that causes serious physical injury, and the simple physical injury element of the assault second? Seems to be an inconsistency there to me.
Well, I think it is a little odd the way it's defined in the code. It's section 222, subsection 4. It says dangerous instrument means any instrument, article, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury, or any disabling chemical spray. That doesn't really apply here. It's not a mace case. So it has to be readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury, but does not, in fact, have to cause serious physical injury.
Well, but it talks in terms of the way in which it was used, and that's really correct. My focus. If I understand the facts correctly, feel free to tell me if I don't, but it seems that the testimony that's unrebutted is that the juvenile struck the stepfather in the hand with the plastic portion of the lacrosse stick, not the netting, not the heavy wooden or plastic part, but the wrapping around the net. And he struck him in the hand. Under those circumstances, given the fact there was no serious physical injury by any definition, but there was simply a physical injury, how is it used as a dangerous instrument under these circumstances sufficiently to satisfy that element of the assault second?
Well, I think it's the focus has to be on whether the instrumentality has the capability of inflicting a serious physical injury.
But doesn't it mean in the circumstances under which it was used? So it would make sense if you took the lacrosse stick and struck someone in the head with it, but by happenstance you didn't cause a serious physical injury, you just cut a gash in their head and they bled profusely, as most head wounds bleed. But there was no serious physical injury. But it was under striking somebody in the head was a circumstance that made that instrument capable of causing a physical injury. It simply didn't, fortunately, under those circumstances. But when you simply hit someone once in the hand, how does that constitute the kind of circumstances contemplated by a felony, the level of second-degree assault?
Well, I think, again, it's the capability of the instrumentality. I think an analogous situation might be using an unloaded gun to strike someone. It's otherwise a dangerous weapon, but it's unloaded, so it's not going to fire a shot, but you use the gun to pistol whip or hit somebody on the head or something like that. I think in that case, because you could inflict serious physical injury, even if you do not and you only inflict physical injury, that's sufficient.
Maybe I'm reading too much into the statute, but it seems to me when you elevate a crime to second degree, what you're trying to do is to prevent people from using instruments dangerously that are capable of causing serious physical injury, and that rational people look at the facts of how it was used and conclude, yes, a lacrosse stick, the reason people wear helmets in the game, the lacrosse stick is capable, if you're hit in the head, of causing some serious physical injury. But on the other hand, if you simply strike someone once in the hand, is that the kind of factual circumstance that the legislature contemplates a charge of a serious assault in the second degree? Is that why they combine the dangerous instrument with physical injury? So people would get a sense of why it's a greater crime than a simple assault which causes physical injury.
Well, I think that's the reason, yes, because that's the distinction between subsections A1 and A2, that in A1 you don't have to use the instrumentality, but you have to cause serious physical injury. In A2 you do have to use either a dangerous weapon or a dangerous instrument. And I think, again, the focus has to be on what's the capability. We've had a number of cases over the years about different objects as to whether or not they qualify as dangerous instruments, and I think the statute has even been amended at least once to make it a little more inclusive than it was at one time.
It was following our bowling ball case.
Yes, I think that was it. There was a bowling ball and some other things.
Let me just finish up with this, and then I'll be quiet and let everybody else do what they want to do, but I just want to keep focused on this for a moment. If the focus is on the intention or the reckless nature of the act, does it make no difference that this was a strike to the hand as opposed to the many alternatives that could, under the circumstances, given this instrument, have in fact caused serious physical injury, and that the way in which the instrument was used or the object was used in this case was inconsistent with an intent to cause a serious physical injury, though it did cause an injury? Why isn't that the rational focus that one would want to look to before finding someone guilty of a serious felony?
Well, I guess then you would probably be restricting the statute more than the legislature intended. What they're trying to discourage, the evil that the statute's aimed at, is people using these type of instrumentalities, either deadly weapons or dangerous instruments, and causing either serious physical injury or simply physical injury in this case. The legislative intent is to discourage the use of those type of instrumentalities, because when you start swinging with a lacrosse stick, you know, you may hit them in the hand, you may hit them in the head, you may hit them in the throat.
Well, let's just focus on the hand for now. And we know that lacrosse players wear big padded gloves. So here the person was hit on the hand and they weren't wearing any gloves. Let's suppose hypothetically that striking a person on their hand with no glove at all broke a bone in the hand. Would that qualify as a serious injury or physical injury, or would that still simply be a physical injury?
I think the case law in Delaware is that broken bones constitute serious physical injuries. If there's a fracture, that's a serious physical injury. If it's just swelling, no fracture, that only is a physical injury. And I think the
what about a muscle tear or a tendon tear?
Don't know if we've had that case yet or not. We've had the fractures and the fracture.
So consistent with that, the state's argument would be using this part of a cross strike to strike someone on an unprotected hand is capable of breaking a bone.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Whether or not the bone was broken.
Yes, I think, and then that's the focus. I mean, my daughter's a goalie, and she wears all this stuff, and she gets whacked all the time, and she doesn't have broken bones, but she gets a lot of swelling, and those are just
physical. It's fair to say there's no medical testimony consistent or inconsistent with that. That's purely speculative.
Oh, absolutely. The only testimony is from the complaining witness. He said he went and got an X-ray. It was negative, and that's all it was.
The state's position regarding dangerous instruments would sweep into its scope practically anything, wouldn't it? I mean, we're not talking about inherently dangerous instruments such as a loaded gun or such as a sword or a hatchet. You could use anything, brick, any inanimate object, and if you use it with enough force, it's capable of causing a serious physical injury.
Well, I think that's true, and that's why there's a distinction between deadly weapons, the hatchet, the bow and arrow, the gun, that we know is capable of causing death or very serious injury, as opposed to other instrumentalities.
But also, aren't we, as I heard you read the statute, talk about whether it's capable of causing serious physical injury under the circumstances in which it's used. For example, let's assume someone's defending themselves with a plastic straw, and they go after their assailant by trying to poke the straw in his eye. Mm-hmm. Under the circumstances, even under this argument, a plastic straw is capable of being a dangerous instrument because in the manner in which it's used, it could cause serious physical injury. Though it may poke the guy in the eye and he went to the emergency room, the only thing that happened was they gave him a bottle of eye wash.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't had the straw case yet. We've had a lot of other things.
No, and occasionally from this bench you get a hypothetical. Some make sense, some don't. But I'm trying to follow up on the theory here of why the focus should not be on the manner in which the person acted and the object that he had in his hand and the way in which he used it, because his options were to go for the head or go for the hand. Mm-hmm. And consistent with fending someone off, he went for the hand and not for the head, which was more consistent with attempting to cause serious physical injury to somebody. And what I'm trying to get straight in my mind is when the legislature says within the same statute, two inconsistent phrases, simple physical injury, and then use of a dangerous instrument, which is capable of causing serious physical injury, why wouldn't a rational person focus on the way in which the instrument was used in order to determine whether it was a dangerous instrument or not, rather than the many hypothetical circumstances under which it might have been used, and then impose criminal liability on how it might have been used to cause serious physical injury, instead of focusing on the way in which, in fact, it was used before you criminalize to the second degree assault felony level the actions of an individual? That's my point.
Well, I think it's simply the way that the statute is written. It doesn't include this facts and circumstances test that Your Honor's set forth here. It just says capable of causing death or serious physical injury. It's the mere capability.
Right, but because that could encompass practically any solid object in the universe.
Well, it may.
Let me finish my question.
I'm sorry.
Doesn't it make sense that the focus should be on what the juvenile's purpose was in using that solid object, rather than the fact that under some circumstances it would be capable
mm-hmm. well, I think
of causing
that goes,
serious physical injury?
I'm sorry. Now, I think that goes back to the definition of the substantive offense itself. There has to be a reckless or intentional conduct. And that's where I think you get into the mental element of the actor. What was the actor really trying to do with this instrumentality? And I think That's the focus, the dangerous instrument definition. It may be very expansive, but I think that's the legislative intent, is to make it expansive.
So your argument is that if there's a legal issue here, it's whether there was sufficient evidence of mens rea under the statute.
Yes,
and
your
argument is there was, and the court came out against the juvenile.
That's correct. And I think, well, when you rule on the motion for judgment acquittal, you only look at the state's evidence. But I think a fair reading of that evidence is that it was an intentional action. The natural and probable consequences of hitting someone with a lacrosse stick is that you intended to cause at least some sort of injury. So I think there was a sufficient basis in the evidence for that, and that's the focus and where the particularized facts and circumstances come into play in analyzing the subjective intent of the actor in this particular case. Given the total quantum of the evidence, the state certainly satisfied each of the three statutory elements beyond a reasonable doubt in this case.
Other than the fact of the existence of a physical injury, which I think everyone has to concede, what's the evidence that he intended to cause physical injury rather than just fending off the stepfather?
Well, that, I think, gets into the other argument that was advanced today as to whether it was simply self-defense or not. And I think here the judge heard all of the evidence, and she was the trier of fact here. There was no jury. So she was free to accept the complaining witness's version as opposed to the accused version, and that all factored into the final decision in rejecting the self-defense claim.
Not intending to cause physical injury or intending to cause physical injury, is it something that's not necessarily relevant to self-defense, is it? You can defend yourself under the statute without any desire to actually cause physical injury to someone else, but just to keep them away from you. And incidentally, they may get hurt if they keep coming after you make it clear you're going to defend yourself. So what, other than the fact of physical injury and the use of the lacrosse stick to strike the hand, is that the sole substance of the inference that he intended to cause physical injury?
Well,
or is it just the fact that his act caused physical injury?
Well, I think it's the latter, that his action caused physical injury. He intended to strike him with a lacrosse stick. He, in fact, struck him in the hand, and there was a physical injury. There was no fracture, so it wasn't a serious physical injury. And that's the sum total of the evidence. It's a relatively straightforward, simple case. I mean, the argument that's being advanced on behalf of the accused was that he was acting in self-defense, but the trial judge heard all of that, and she rejected that. She was the final determiner of the fact and the assessor of the credibility of the respective witnesses in this case.
It's interesting to me that the mens rea the state selected was intentional rather than reckless. I can understand the fact situation would say if you struck someone in the hand with a lacrosse stick, one of the things that could happen is physical injury, whether you intended it to or not. But that's not what you chose to charge. You chose to charge that he intended to cause that physical injury.
Well, I think that's true, and they probably made the burden a little tougher for the state than the statute required. They could have simply elected a reckless. It's a curious statute because it has alternative mental states. You can either be reckless or intentional, and as long as you arrive at the same result, that's sufficient.
Well, as you stated earlier, it's probably the legislature wanting to encompass every possible act conceivable and make a second-degree assault felony out of it.
Well, I think they're trying to discourage use of instrumentalities. And the reason for that is because once you start picking up these objects, that's when there is a potential for greater injury or greater harm. And that, I think, was the focus in the legislature's action. And that's why, in fact, the statute has been amended to make it a little more inclusive than it was originally. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
You wish to add anything to rebuttal?
It appears the state is arguing that any time someone picks up any instrument, they have to be able to determine what it may be capable of doing, what kind of harm it may be causing. And the defense would suggest that that's such a nebulous frame of mind that hardly anyone, if anyone, could be put on notice as to what would be prohibited. And absent the testimony of the actual defendant or any other testimony by those who heard him say something, it would be also just as impossible for the court to ascertain what was the intent of the defendant if all we look to is capability rather than the actual use.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.